Hello, my name's Mark Littlewood. I'm the Director General here at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Thanks for joining us for this latest in the IEA series of vidcasts and podcasts. And today I'm delighted to be joined by my good friend and a good friend of freedom in the IEA, Toby Young. Toby's a journalist, the former director of the New Schools Network, and founder and director of the recently established Free Speech Union. He's author of several books, including The Sound of No Hands Clapping, How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, which was the basis for a 2008 comedy film of the same name. And he's also the associate editor of both The Spectator and Quillette. Today we'll be discussing free speech. The IEA exists to further the public understanding of free market economics and the fundamental institutions of a free society, of which free speech is clearly an important part. But what's the current state of free speech in the UK? What does free speech actually mean? And what does Toby's Free Speech Union hope to achieve? And is unbridled free speech either necessary or desirable? To answer all those questions and more, it's really great to have you with us. A very warm welcome, Toby Young.
Thank you very much, Mark. Great to be here.
So perhaps we can start, Toby, right at the beginning, always a good place to start. Tell us, I'll ask about the ins and outs of the Free Speech Union in a minute, but tell us why it's even necessary. What's the state of free speech in the United Kingdom at the moment? It's seen, I guess, as a fundamental right by nearly all of us, but also one that we can take for granted. Why can't we take it for granted?
Well, I think that free speech is probably in greater peril at present than at any time since the Second World War. And there are various bits of evidence you can cite to demonstrate that, but I'll confine myself to two. In the academy, I think most people watching this will know that free speech isn't valued nearly as highly as it once was. But a fairly persuasive piece of evidence in that regard was a survey carried out by a couple of academics at Lincoln University in 2017 on behalf of the UCU, which is the largest academic trade union in the UK. And these academics looked at, they tried to measure how well protected free speech is in every EU member state, in the universities of every EU member state, by using a variety of metrics. And they concluded that free speech was less well protected in the UK than in every other EU member state, bar one. Another piece of evidence is one that recently came to light when Harry Miller, the ex-cop who was questioned by Humberside Police after he liked a tweet which contained a comic verse about transgendered people. Merely for liking that tweet, he was interviewed by the police, and the investigating officer opened the interview by telling him he'd need to check his thinking. He wasn't prosecuted, but that tweet was recorded as a non-crime hate incident. And we know that non-crime hate incidents, if they are included on your record, can show up if a potential employer does an enhanced DBS check on you. So merely having that on your record can prevent you from being employed as a carer or a teacher and so forth. Now, Harry turned out to be the wrong guy, as in Quentin Tarantino's definition of the wrong guy. Tarantino was once asked, what kind of guy do you want to be? And he said, I want to be the wrong guy, the guy in the movie who people refer to as the wrong guy to mess with. Well, Harry Miller was the wrong guy to mess with. He took Humberside Police and the College of Policing, whose official hate crime guidance the police were following, to the High Court and won a partial victory in that the judge agreed that the police should not have investigated Harry for liking this tweet, that they behaved like the Gestapo. I think the judge even compared Humberside Police to the Stasi. But he stopped short, unfortunately, of declaring the official College of Policing guidance unlawful, and didn't say that including the non-crime hate incident on Harry Miller's record was unlawful. So Harry is now trying to appeal that ruling to the Supreme Court, and if he succeeds, the Free Speech Union will try and join that appeal. But in the wake of this judgment, the Telegraph did an FOI request to try and discover how many people had been investigated for non-crime hate incidents in the past 5 years. And it turned out in England and Wales that more than 120,000 people had been investigated for non-crime hate incidents, which by my reckoning is about 66 a day. And it just beggars belief that the police, you know, particularly in the midst of a knife crime epidemic, should be wasting precious resources, valuable time on investigating people misgendering one another on Twitter instead of actually solving crimes. But anyway, it seems to me that that was really persuasive evidence that free speech has been allowed to be neglected in this country, and an organization needs to be created to stand up for it.
So is it, you've given us these two examples, the academy and the behavior of the police force going around telling people to check their thinking rather than actually securing our safety. Is it your view, therefore, that the real problem here are authorities or people in power or influence who are sort of acting in an ultra vires way, but they've decided that they want to go around and make sure we're all thinking the sound thoughts from their perspective? Or is it the problem of the law itself? I mean, it sounds in the Harry Miller case that actually the English law is providing a pretty robust defence against the police telling us to check our thinking. So is it a legal problem, or is it a sort of cultural problem with public bodies out of control and interfering and not undertaking their prime objective, or a mix of the two?
Well, that's an interesting question, Mark. And one of the things the Free Speech Union is doing, it's established a research arm. And we are looking at whether there are any laws on the statute books which need to be repealed, or whether the boundaries can be firmly put in place by case law. And it's really a combination of the two. The fundamental problem is that under English common law, free speech is essentially very well protected. But all the laws that have been put in place which take precedence over English common law, which relate to speech, have essentially encroached upon our free speech. So I think the ideal solution would just be to sweep away all those acts of parliament and revert to common law. But politically, it's probably not going to happen. So what can we do? Well, we can try and persuade the government to amend some of the more censorious, draconian laws. We can try and dissuade the government from passing even more censorious laws. So, for instance, there's a hate crime bill currently before the Scottish Parliament, which is going to criminalise various things that you and I would think are completely innocuous. People who, for instance, gender critical feminists, to challenge some of the more extreme dogma of the trans Taliban, for instance, could be prosecuted under this new law before the Scottish Parliament. And the FSU, needless to say, is going to be submitting evidence to the Justice Committee of the Scottish Parliament to try and at least improve that law, even if we can't get it thrown out. But in addition, yes, you can judicially review bad policies and bad laws, which is what Harry Miller and his legal team did. I think Harry got lucky in that he had a pretty good judge. Sometimes decisions like that can go the other way, so it's not a 100% reliable way of making sure that the police and various officials don't overreach. There was another victory that Harry's group, his legal team anyway, secured recently. The CPS, in collaboration with various left-wing lobby groups like Stonewall and Gendered Intelligence, had issued guidance for schools urging teachers to essentially dob in children who didn't abide by the very latest kind of trendy thinking about how many genders there are and so forth. Literally report them to the police with a view to having them prosecuted for committing hate crimes, children as young as five. Absolutely right. Absurd. And that was successfully challenged, and that's now been thrown out. So I think it's a combination, to answer your question, it's a combination of changing the law, making sure no new laws are introduced, which make the situation even worse, and where possible, challenging bad laws in the courts. Okay.
And I want to get into some of the nuts and bolts of what the Free Speech Union's doing, its mission, its purpose, the battles it will be engaged in. But I want to ask you some philosophical questions about freedom of speech, because as I said at the outset, It's sort of universally praised. I mean, I haven't met very many people who actually say freedom of speech isn't worth having. But it's quite important, I think, to philosophically define what we mean by it and what its acceptable limits are. So you've given some examples of incidents in which I think most sensible, right-thinking people would be appalled. But do you have a sort of framework in your mind of what limitations on free speech are indeed acceptable? I mean, obviously, the famous old one is you don't have the freedom of speech to shout fire in a theatre. I think you do actually have the freedom to say that. It's just a breach of your contractual terms on your ticket. We have laws against defamation that impinges upon freedom of speech. What about sort of freedom of speech marshalled in private places? I mean, to give you an example, if the employees of the IEA, including myself, undertake not to say or discuss certain things, for example, partisan politics, in order to protect the reputation of the IEA. So do you have in your mind not just some of these absolutely appalling, egregious examples, but some sort of philosophical framework, and indeed some examples of where you think freedom of speech is legitimately curtailed?
Yes. Well, I think it is legitimately curtailed in a number of areas I'm sure most people would agree on. Child pornography, state secrets, defamation, although you get into a slightly grey area there. I think the broad definition beyond those categories where I think it's acceptable to limit free speech is that is for the most part subscribed to by the US Supreme Court, which is to permit speech, save for that speech which is going to directly lead to violence against an identifiable group or individual. So it's not sufficient to say that it could lead to violence, nor is it sufficient to say that it could lead to a kind of general civil disorder. You have to be able to show that if this person or this publication is allowed to go public, then it will directly lead to violence against a specific identifiable individual or group. Short of that, I don't think the state is justified in limiting free speech.
But what about in private spaces? I mean, let me give you a fairly innocuous example. I don't think this has happened in my tenure at the IEA, but if at one of our dinners or events, one of the guests started effing and blinding, well, that's no threat to national security or anything like that. Nobody will die from it, but I would shut them down and have them ejected. Is the academy any different? I mean, if a university wants to say our offerings to our students come exclusively from Marxist professors of history, is that really a freedom of speech matter? I mean, the state isn't intervening. It's being policed by a private body in the same way, I guess, a socialist bookstore might not stock your books, Toby, or books by conservative philosophers. Are you concerned at all, or are you relaxed about the private policing of free speech? Because it seems to me the police and the academy are rather different in that regard, right? The state curating what can be said at an IEA dinner is one thing, but certainly we, the IEA, curate it and would kick people out and discipline our staff if they said the wrong thing. So what about in that private space?
I think this is a genuine difficulty, particularly for classical liberals, which I count myself as. You want to protect free speech, but on the other hand, you don't want the state to encroach on the freedom of private associations. But I think that whilst that might apply to an organisation like the IEA, I'm not sure it does apply to universities, at least not the vast majority of universities, which are, after all, publicly funded institutions. And this comes up in the US because when you try and make sure universities, public universities, abide by the First Amendment, you can. Private universities, it's more difficult, though there are various mechanisms you can use. Where this is a difficulty for the Free Speech Union is lots of our members complain about having videos taken down by YouTube, being kicked off Facebook and Twitter. We've got a case at the moment, a Scottish nationalist kicked off Twitter for using the C word. Normally when that happens, people get temporarily banned. He appears to have been permanently banned. So we're looking into that. But it's quite tricky because these are, after all, private companies. So should the state have the power, whether directly or via the courts, to enforce free speech in these private companies? And we're still debating that amongst the directors and staff of the FSU. I think my broad principle is that if it's in the public square, and I count Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube as being part of the public square, then I think there are rules regarding free speech that should be observed. Exactly what the best way to make sure companies like Google observe those rules, that's up to debate. One would hope that the market itself, left to its own devices, could correct for any over-censorious behavior on the part of social media companies, the big tech giants. That doesn't seem to be happening, in part because they've got such a huge monopoly. If the market was perhaps a little freer, then it might begin to happen. And of course, there are rival social media platforms with much less censorious content moderation policies than Facebook and Twitter, but they find it hard to establish any kind of foothold in the marketplace because of the dominance, the monopoly of those companies. But one would hope that through a combination of public shaming, nipping around the edges with lawsuits and so forth, that one could try and persuade large companies that are very much central to the kind of national debate, the public conversation, to be a bit more respectful of free speech.
Okay, and I'll come to the tactics and strategy of the Free Speech Union in just a minute, but I'd like to get your thoughts on the Academy. You mentioned this report from Lincoln University that we'll include a link to if we can. That we're the second worst country in the European Union? Who's the worst?
I can't remember. I think it may have, I could take a guess, but I could easily get it wrong.
But again, and you've already in the early days of the FSU done some good work, as you say, sort of nipping around the edges, challenging certain things, like, for example, Amber Rudd being no-platformed at Oxford University. But again, do you think it's guerrilla warfare? Or are there some particular, I don't know, rules or laws or funding protocols that you think should change? That, you know, unless you do X, you lose your university charter or you don't get any funding from the state or whatever else it might be? Or is it a question of, which you've done to great effect, drawing to public attention egregious behaviour on the part of what are often private actors?
Well, in the case of British universities, the government has talked about the possibility of passing a new law to try and make sure free speech is upheld at British universities. But actually there are numerous laws already on the statute books, as well as Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which protect free speech and which apply to impose legal obligations on universities. The trouble is that many of those laws, even universities' own policies, which often reflect those laws, are more often honoured in the breach than the observant. So what can be done to make sure universities stick to their principles and obey the law? Well, one thing you can do is threaten them with legal action, draw attention to the fact that their students, as in the case of Amber Rudd, seem to be completely ignoring the university's own policy with respect to freedom of speech. And I think given that the government is making threatening noises in the background, that certainly helps. It means that universities know they have to get their own house in order and can't continue to ignore their legal obligations. And if they do, there will be action taken, which may end up making their lives more difficult. I think one problem that we face in this country is that the Equality Act of 2010 did place various legal obligations on public bodies, including universities, not to discriminate or harass various groups. And universities have tried to reflect those obligations in their diversity and inclusion and equality policies and so forth. And sometimes they come into conflict with their commitment to free speech. You know, the argument would be that if you invite Nigel Farage onto campus to participate in a debate about immigration, that that could constitute a form of harassment against the
children. Because it triggers Remainers or something. What would be the?
Well,
what would be
I think the argument would be that it would make some minorities uncomfortable and reluctant to participate in this debate, and that would constitute a form of discrimination which they have a legal obligation to prevent. And universities have been interpreting the Equality Act in order to essentially stop right-wing voices from being heard in the academy. And so one thing I think could be done would be to reform the Equality Act to make it absolutely clear that where there is a conflict between one of the public duties in the Equality Act and the legal obligation to uphold free speech, at least as far as universities are concerned, then free speech should take priority. And one of the things the FSU is doing is preparing a report on how exactly we think the Equality Act could be reformed to make sure it isn't abused in this way.
Okay, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you see the difference on university campus, because this does seem to be, notwithstanding the UK's particularly poor rating, a problem really right across the Western world. Certainly on the other side of the Atlantic, there are very serious concerns that young people at university are not being exposed to the full breadth of ideas and philosophies. But how much of it is the academy, the universities themselves? You know, everybody in the history department needs to be an ideological Marxist. That's sort of one category of problem. Or how much is it, if you like, I hesitate to say this, but the fault of young people themselves, you know, student societies, the entirely volunteer-run debating society refusing to have Nigel Farage, much more of a sort of private club, nothing really there to do with the academy. Nigel Farage isn't applying to be a professor of politics anywhere. He's just a potential guest speaker. And again, presumably those societies, you know, have to carry out their own editorial policy. I mean, you can understand why the Oxford University Science Society might not give a platform to a flat earther, for example, a literal flat earther. Just say that that's just such a nuts idea, we're not going to have it. Or a left-leaning group might not give a platform to Nigel Farage because they're the Oxford University Social Democrat Remainer Society or whatever. Is it a sort of student union woke young people problem that they want to spend 3 years in a safe space at university only being exposed to fluffy stuff that they know and love? Or is it an academy problem? And what's the balance between the two if it's both?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. According to Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, who wrote this book, The Coddling of the American Mind, it's largely a problem rooted in the psychological fragility of millennials and Generation Z. They're brought up in cocooned in cotton wool. They have these helicopter parents who protect them from threat. They don't have any idea how to manage risk. They're not used to being challenged. They're very sensitive, not very psychologically robust. When they arrive at university, they want the comfort of safe spaces and trigger warnings and so on and so forth, and find intellectual challenge psychologically very unsettling. But I think that's a misdiagnosis. I think that there's a grain of truth in that, but I think for the most part, the reason there is this free speech crisis, as you say, across the Anglosphere, and it is, I think, particularly bad in the Anglosphere, is because of the rise of postmodernist Marxist ideologues, not just in the humanities, but also in the social sciences, and increasingly now in the hard sciences. And I think they essentially enlist the support of these students as another way, almost as a cover, for trying to enforce their own ideological dogma and punish anyone who dissents from it. And they weaponize the fragility of this generation in order to try and police campuses and cleanse them of any dissent from their doctrines. But I think the real problem is with these hard left-wing extremist professors, and the snowflakes are just useful idiots.
Okay, now, so tell us a bit about the Free Speech Union. Is this a Is this a union in the sense that most people would understand a union for people who speak? What led you to set it up? When did you set it up? What's it do? What's it done? What's its mission in the next year or two? And what sort of skirmishes, fights, and intellectual battles are you going to be involved in? And how do people get involved with it?
Well, we describe it as a non-partisan mass membership organization which stands up for the speech rights of its members. Legally, it's not a union, but I think it does have quite a lot in common with other trade unions, particularly in their first incarnation in the 19th century. One reason, after all, for the creation of trade unions was to enable workers to criticize their bosses and criticize the ruling class without losing their jobs. And, you know, we certainly think there's a lot in banding together and acting collectively and speaking with one voice. You know, the enemies of free speech hunt in packs, and I think its defenders need to band together too. We protect our members' speech rights in a variety of ways. If someone is kicked off a social media platform, we'll do our best to get them reinstated, though it is quite difficult and we don't want to overpromise in that regard. If someone has a legal case, if they've been fired for dissent, for instance, we can in some cases provide them with pro bono legal advice. We've advised several students who've been put through a disciplinary process for saying something, you know, right of center, but extremely mild, even by our own standards, but who've been put through kind of vexatious disciplinary processes by university authorities. We've gone to bat for them and pushed back against those enforcement officers, who are usually kind of your typical kind of woke thought police types. In some cases, we can help people challenge things by judicially reviewing decisions or policies. We have an educational arm in which we're going to be encouraging students and sixth formers to set up free speech societies, advising them about how best to protect them from officials who try and obstruct them, advising them what their legal rights are and what they can appeal to defend various speakers they want to invite to come and address those societies. So we've got this think tank arm, as I said, which will be publishing various research papers about where we think free speech is in danger and how it can be better protected. So we're doing a number of things. I mean, one of the areas we want to be active in is defending people on social media if they're targeted by outrage mobs and publicly shamed in the way that, for instance, Roger Scruton was last year. And he ended up, as you know, being fired from his government job, and if the government later to apologize and reinstate him. But Twitter mobs are extraordinarily powerful. Lots of politicians and influential people seem to take their lead from Twitter mobs and do their bidding for fear of being targeted themselves, or because they think somehow they're almost like focus groups kind of reflecting kind of public opinion. So if someone is targeted for cancellation on Facebook or Twitter, we'll go to bat for them. We'll try and enlist the support of all our members to jump on and defend those people, start hashtags defending them. If an open letter is circulated about one of our members calling them to be fired because they've dissented from progressive orthodoxy, we'll circulate a counter petition, which will hopefully be signed by a more distinguished group of academics and intellectuals and journalists defending them, and so on and so forth. So I think there are a number of things we can do and have been doing.
And you'll, am I right that you'll defend the freedom of speech of all 7.5 billion human beings, not just your members? Your members provide the heft and the workforce and the campaigning power, but you'll step into bat for, well, I guess anyone who expresses an opinion within the British Isles, right? Even if they're not an FSU member, is that right?
Well, our first duty is to protect the speech rights of our members, and that's where most of our energy goes. But if there is an important principle at stake, as there is, we think, in the Harry Miller case, we will intervene try and uphold free speech in that case, because we think it benefits everyone, including our members. But you know, the kind of legal support that we've been able to provide is limited to our members.
Okay, and Is it come one, come all, or are there any sort of principles that you have to uphold by being an FSU member? As I've mentioned, the IEA has a kind of basically a disrepute clause for its staff. So if you say something on Twitter, even if it's perfectly legal, if it brings the IEA into disrepute, you might be in disciplinary trouble. You might even lose your job. Are you willing to accept anyone, you know, Holocaust deniers, 9/11 conspiracy theorists, anti-Semites? Is it irrelevant to you at all what their ideology or their particular cause or pet peeve is? Or are you more narrow than that? Or is it open to absolutely everybody, irrespective of where they stand on the political or ideological spectrum?
Well, like most other unions, as I understand it, we don't vet people who apply to become members. You can just join by filling out a form on our website, freespeechunion.org. But if once you've joined, don't keep faith with our statement of values, which is published on our website, then we do reserve the right to kick you out. And what those values are essentially are a commitment to upholding free speech. So it means not engaging in bullying or other forms of intimidation to silence your opponents, not actively trying to inhibit the free speech of others. But provided you sign up to those statement of values, we won't defend you in every case. Sometimes someone will say something provocative or offensive on social media, they won't be mobbed in response, but because thousands of people react simultaneously en masse, condemning what they've said or challenging what they've said, it can feel to them as though they've been targeted by an outrage mob. Actually, that's just democratic free speech in action. And we sure wouldn't go to bat for someone who that's happening to. Broadly speaking, if our members stay within the law and they are being harassed by the public authorities, dragged through the courts, fired from their jobs, something along those lines, if they're suffering ridiculous and disproportionate consequences merely for saying something unconventional or for dissenting from a prevailing orthodoxy, then yes, we will go to bat for them. I mean, I think people say, how could you possibly go to bat for a Holocaust denier? Well, I think the answer is you have to, provided a Holocaust denier is allowed to set out their stall in the public square, then that gives everyone who takes issue with what they're saying an opportunity to rebut what they're saying. And I think that's a far better way to defeat toxic ideologies than to push them underground. I mean, this came up
recently. A really interesting example of that is there's certainly a correlation between the collapse of the British National Party and Nick Griffin appearing on Question Time for the first time, right? Because as soon as he was there, it was evident that his arguments didn't stand up to even the remotest scrutiny. But had he actually been banned from appearing, he may well have remained as a political influence for a considerable period of time to come. I mean, it exposed it.
Great example, yeah. And the anti-free speech activists were out in force, you know, protesting outside the BBC, saying it was dangerous to give this man a platform. It was effectively the BBC legitimizing his point of view. And actually, as you say, support for the BNP almost collapsed overnight after his appearance on Question Time, after members of the audience and the panelists were given a chance to challenge some of the obviously toxic and factually inaccurate things he was saying. Another good example, Mark, this one yet to be resolved, but Ofcom recently reprimanded ITV and London Live for giving airtime to the view that there's a connection between 5G masts and the symptoms that have been described as coronavirus. In the case of London Live, it was sanctioned by Ofcom for giving David Icke, for interviewing David Icke, even though the interviewer challenged him and he wasn't given a free ride. And in the interview itself, they even flashed up the government website where you can go to get official advice about social distancing and so forth. Ofcom decided that that was dangerous, and they haven't decided whether they're going to fine London Live yet, but wow, it looks as though they're thinking about doing that. In the case of ITV, Eamon Holmes said that people like David Icke should have an opportunity to articulate this hypothesis in the public square, if only so it can be firmly rebutted. And he himself, he said, didn't think it was true. He thought it was obviously silly, but he didn't think that people should be banned from airing this theory in public. And that's quite right. Same principle as Nick Griffin. You know, sunlight is the best form of disinfectant. But Ofcom took a different view. They decided that under the present circumstances, it was dangerous. The public couldn't be trusted not to overreact if people like David Icke are allowed to advance this hypothesis. We think that was an absurd decision, and it's alarming because Ofcom has been tasked with cleansing social media of harmful content under the new online harms proposal that the Home Office has drawn up. And we've written a robust letter to Ofcom. They've responded. We're about to respond again.
So do you think an overarching problem here is that, if you like, the right to not be offended, and that's often a right that's exercised by other groups on your behalf, like Ofcom, is beginning to out-trump the right to freedom of expression. We are considered by the authorities to be so fragile and insecure, or so stupid that we'll believe any theory that was put to us on television, that protection is more necessary than freedom of expression. And God help you if you... God help you if you in any way offend anybody. I mean, that puts your whatever opinion you voiced completely beyond the pale if they're just subjectively offended, if they put their arms in the air and say they can't take it anymore. Is that really the underlying cultural problem we've got? The right not to be offended, or the infantilization of the adult population, is the excuse by which a free exchange of opinions and views is increasingly being policed?
Yes, I think that's broadly right. The phrase that comes up most often, I think, the one that's invoked both by the police and by social media companies, is hate speech. That free speech doesn't entitle you it doesn't mean you're free to utter hate speech. And the idea is that hate speech, if people hear it, is going to prompt them to behave violently towards minorities, historically disadvantaged mm-hmm. groups, people in protected categories, and they don't feel that they have to, as in the Supreme Court standard, show that the speech in question will imminently lead directly to violence being committed against a particular individual or group. Rather, it's because there's a possibility that this particular speech could, at some point in the future, in some hypothetical scenario, prompt someone to commit violence. And they link it to things like the Christchurch church shooting and so forth. Boris Johnson, for instance, was accused of hate speech for making a gag about burqa-wearing women in his Telegraph column. Even the Tory party investigated him for Islamophobia, though he was subsequently found to be innocent. But yeah, it's a completely spurious pretext on which to shut down right of center voices in the public square. And as you say, it depends upon this view of the public as this kind of infantile, or perhaps childlike would be better, mm-hmm. That they're childlike and very easily influenced and prompted to behave in this kind of violent and irrational way just by reading something like a gag in the Daily Telegraph in Boris Johnson's column. And when you ask them to provide evidence that there is any direct causal link between something like the burqa column and violence committed against burqa wearing women on the streets of Bradford, they really struggle.
Sure. Well, Toby, we're clear out of time. Just to underscore again, though, that for people to find out more about the FSU or to join and become a member, it's freespeechunion.org is the website to go to. Have I got that right? And we'll make sure that's in the show notes on YouTube. So if you go to the description below, you can link right through. There'll be links to some other interesting things there as well. Toby, it's been an absolute pleasure to be joined by you to give you a platform for the freedom of your own expressions, even under this new norm of socialist house arrest. We can find some ways in the free market to share our views and broadcast and get them out there. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your ideas with us. We'll talk to you again very soon, and good luck holding the torch for freedom of expression. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure. As you know, I'm a huge fan of the IEA, so more power to your elbow.
Bless you. Thanks, Toby. All the best.
Cheers.
Again, Toby, and thank you very much to all of you for watching. During these protracted times of lockdown, the IEA is making more digital content than ever before. New podcasts and vidcasts go up daily. If you enjoyed this conversation and you want to see more of our stuff, then make sure you hit subscribe if you're watching on YouTube, and also hit the bell, the notification bell. That will mean that you get details of all of our upcoming vidcasts and podcasts. You can also follow our podcasts at ieapodcast.podbean.com. And please also visit our website, iea.org.uk. And on our website, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, IEA Daily, and find out more about the IEA Book Club too. Thanks for joining us. Stay safe.